Hello, Didi Halleck.
Hello, Tetsuo.
This is Tetsuo, yes. How are you?
Good.
Yeah, now our voices are in the net.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so can I have an interview with you?
Sure.
Yeah, I have a lot of questions, but tonight, this is night here, especially about micro radio. Since mid-90s in the U.S., a micro radio movement has finally started, and the FCC approved to make a new license of micro radio, I think. However, the situation is very complicated. NEA tried to bring it to nothing. So could you explain a little bit about what's going now in this area?
Well, there's still an ongoing struggle. The national, it's NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters, which includes, interestingly enough, the non-commercial broadcasters, PBS Radio, which you would think is supposed to be the public entity, has been one of the on the forefront of working against micro radio. What's happening now is that there is a rulemaking, and there have been some several hundred people who non-commercial organizations, community organizations, who have applied and who have gotten provisional. What they call construction permits to begin to construct micro radio. And however, the ruling is all being questioned by both, on one hand, the National Association of Broadcasters, who don't want to have anything of micro radio, and on the other hand, the religious broadcasters from the right wing, who want to be allowed to also have mic radio, because they right now they are excluded. The provisions say that it cannot be promoting religion. So you have a situation where there is an ongoing process for certain community groups, and actually I've seen the list of the stations that have been granted permits. I believe it's about 700, and they're very good organizations, including the Indian reservations and community groups in the inner cities, and it's a very interesting and quite diverse group of people who have been granted construction licenses. However, there's no provision for the pioneers, the people like Stephen Dunifer, like the Lower East Side Radio, who have been at the forefront of trying to really push for micro radio. And unfortunately, Stephen Dunifer just lost a big court opinion and has an injunction against any kind of transmission at this time. That is, he's from Radio Free Berkeley in the East Bay in California.
Yeah, Stephen Dunifer once told me that he is not so much interested in the license by the FCC, because he insists in free radio. So that his case is a little bit different from the present situation. Do you think so?
Well, I think it is, but I think that it highlights I think obviously we all would like to have open free broadcasting, but I think that at the same time, Stephen Dunifer has been one of the people who is pushing to have micro radio decriminalized, so it's not a crime to do broadcasting, and in a sense, the granting of these licenses is a kind of compromise between those who want complete free radio and those who want to have no radio at all. But what's happening, actually, the whole issue of micro radio has been very useful in actually focusing the public's attention to issues about the spectrum and radio and transmission and media politics in general. And in fact, on September 23rd, there will be a major meeting of the National Associations of Broadcasters and in the Bay Area in San Francisco. And preparing to meet that group is a very large constituency of not only people who work with free radio, but also people who are organizing around community television, etc. And there will be big demonstrations. Some people think it will be on the level of what happened in Seattle, because it's become a real kind of focus of a lot of the energy around issues around media. So this would be on September 23rd, and there is, if you go to the Indy Media site, there is a link to the San Francisco activities, and there's a week-long list of activities. People are going to be making posters and props and puppets and to march around to confront the National Association of Broadcasters. So that could be very interesting, September 23rd.
Yeah, I think so. I think the whole situation of micro radio in last 5 or 6 years, I think it's great. Do you think why this situation has started? Because when I saw you in the 70s at the time, there was less interest in micro radio, I think. How do you argue why this interest, new interest in micro radio has been started?
Well, I think there are several things that are going on here. I think one is that the radio stations, the commercial stations, have just become more and more sort of transnational, trans-local. They don't even, many of them are automated. They don't really respond to a kind of public, and they play these playlists that are dictated from above. So you've lost the kind of the intimacy and the kind of the interaction between the radio teenage and young people, radio fans, and their DJs and the people who used to run these radio stations. And now they're so totally corporate that I think the youth are looking for other outlets, and also that the technology is such that once you have Walkman, it's not that far to have Talkman. So I think the technology has also allowed this very easy and very accessible kind of transmission. And then I think the web is also a big encouragement for micro radio, because you can exchange and have use of the web. For example, during the protests in LA and Philadelphia around the conventions, at the independent media centers, we had a radio room in each of the centers, and they were doing 24-hour transmissions to the web. But of course, there were people around the town who also were transmitting. They would receive the web broadcast and then transmit the signal out, broadcast it out for a broader public. So, for example, in D.C., during the demonstrations there, anywhere you went in Washington, I think I don't even think it was low power. I think it was a very high power radio.
Yeah.
They were using many, and it's not just one. It's several entities will retransmit, so that you had, it was very intense. And also from Philadelphia, they had, because people in the prison who were being arrested by the police kept their cell phones, and then they would call into the radio station and go on live, and that would go on the web, and then that would be transmitted out to these micro radios around the town. It's just a quite interesting interconnection of several different kinds of technology.
Yeah, I myself have been involved in micro radio activities. The problem here in recent years is frequency. There are less and less free frequency in the FM dials.
Yeah.
big institutionalized stations monopolized the frequency. So I think the from now on we should demand free space of FM dials for micro transmission. In the United States, is there any this kind of
dedicated frequency?
Yeah.
Well, there is actually the lower. The lower numbers are supposed to be, there's supposed to be a kind of area for non-commercial, which, you know, has not been for micro, but I think this is a very good idea. I think there should be dedicated space for having, you know, community, local radio community use, et cetera. I think this is a very important.
There is a special, areas in the frequency in the United States?
Beg your pardon?
There is a special frequency of FM dials in.
There is actually. It's a lower number. So for example, it's like I think 94 down is supposed to be for non-commercial. That was the way it was initially set up. But now with this kind of bartering and the total commercialization of the frequencies, a non-commercial license can sell their license to a commercial station. So then it would change to be a commercial station. So there is a lot of, you know, a lot of exchange in that area. So it's not as pure as it was initially decided as dedicated. You know, there's a Robert McChesney. Has written very good book on this area of media and democracy and the whole struggle around FM in history of American broadcasting. He, I think it's mass media and democracy, and he's a very interesting researcher, and he found all the struggles and all the different educational organizations and labor unions who fought in the late 20s to try to preserve an area of the spectrum that would be dedicated for non-commercial and educational broadcasting. So we're trying to kind of revive some of that work right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the unions are getting much more interested in this area. So.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, actually, in Chicago, a union had a radio station from like 1928 on, and it was a very important radio station. But lately, more unions are getting interested in the media and are realizing that they have to get involved and to have their voices heard. There's a group called UpNet, Union Producers and Programmers Network. That actually they visited Korea. They're in touch with some of the labor producers in Korea, and they have exchange of programming on community television, and they've become very involved with media politics and trying to secure spectrum for labor issues.
I think it's very interesting. I think that in recent years, I think the Independent Media Center you mentioned has a great work to circulate information, video, not only sound, but also a video. So
interesting thing has been the collaboration.
Yeah.
I mean, there was always these different communities, the video people and the radio people and the print people and the people who are doing photography, and now with these independent media centers, there's been a kind of collaboration that had never happened before that's been extremely energizing and very exciting. But not without the attempt to shut it down. Los Angeles, the first night we were to be broadcasting from our satellite truck, we had rented a truck, and it was to go up to the satellite and out to 100 community stations around the country, and also the DBS. We have a channel now on DBS, and the police, under a very transparently phony kind of accusation, closed down the whole parking lot and wouldn't let our engineers into the truck to turn on the satellite, and because they said there was a bomb threat, and they had to actually look into this yellow hippie van that was out there, and it was just ridiculous. But and we ended up having to go to the city council and to the various members of the state legislature to try to call the police off and get them off. So the next night we were able to broadcast. But when it was down, the interesting thing happened. When it was, because we already had the satellite time, but we could not, we didn't have the means to send the signal up to the satellite.
I see.
However, we asked the satellite company to put a slate on the signal, because we were paying for the signal anyway, because we'd already rented it. So we had them put on, this transmission has been interrupted by the LAPD, the Los Angeles Police Department. Please call, and we gave the LAPD's number, 1-800-LAPD or something, right? And the next morning we got a call from the Los Angeles Police saying, could we please take down that sign, because they were getting calls from all over the country, so much so that they jammed their 1-800 network, and they had no one could get in. So we had a very good response to that, because people really put pressure on the LAPD to stop that.
Uh-huh.
So it was a very interesting use of the satellite to garner activism against the LAPD.
I see. I have much more questions about globalization and prison programs. I think I have to have another chance, maybe next month.
Okay.
But finally, please briefly comment. Give me a brief comment about recent trends of the police, because as I looked at the video and news of Independent Media Center, I think. The police attack to the demonstration and peace activity of people, it becomes more and more aggressive and violent. So why this kind of brutal tendency that happens in the United States today?
Well, I think the reaction is in proportion to the power of the movement. I think that the movement is very strong, and I think that the police have to act very swiftly and brutally. And actually, there's some interesting discussions of this that have been leaked out from particularly the Canadian securities apparatus, and talking about how to cut off the head of the snake quickly. But I think that what happens is that then we're able to document the brutality. And for example, in Washington, there's a very serious lawsuit that is going on about the actions of the police, and the video and the website and the still photography has been used in a very, groundbreaking way to actually identify certain particular policemen and to track their activities and to show various, for example, the police covered their badges, and we have close-ups on the web of particular policemen with their badge numbers with tape over it so you can't read their badges. And that is going to be used, and that's already being used in a lawsuit against the D.C. police for doing that. And I think it becomes an interesting kind of battle of the information that I think we have. That's why it's so important to have the video and the photographs there, to make sure that the that their activities are documented.
Okay, very good. Finally, do you have any message to your friends in Japan?
Well, stay tuned. Watch the Indie Media site, and hopefully we. I think the collaboration with people in Japan is very important. I know, for example, my friend Papoleto from Puerto Rico went down to Vieques, and while he was there, there were people visiting from Okinawa, and I think the whole way that people who have similar problems across the world are now able to support each other. I think the movement against the bases and the militarization of various communities by the U.S. military, I think it's important. It is amazing that people are now really collaborating and working together to fight this kind of militarization, and I think it's very important that we stay in touch.
Very good. Thank you very much, PD. See you again, and maybe next month you could talk to us.
Yes, and watch the website.
Yeah. Bye now.
All right.